Radio. Welcome, and thank you for joining Human Interest today. I'm Mary Ann Reese, the host of Human Interest. If you're just joining us, I just want to share with you that our programs are primarily conversational, and our intent is to share information that may lead to a more holistic awareness of issues and perspectives on various topics, topics that might evoke the human qualities of curiosity, compassion, empathy, motivation, laughter, and perhaps even anger. In the studio with me today is Becky Duval Reese, my sister, our producer Rob Rourke, and today's guest is Lamar Hankins. Our topic today is My Life, My Death, My Choice, also known as The Right to Die. I want to share a little background with Lamar before we get discussing this topic. Lamar is a retired lawyer, and indeed he's a former city attorney here in San Marcos, Texas. He currently does pro bono work, and I can tell you from having read a lot of his writing, he writes exceptionally well, researches, and writes very thoughtful articles about legal, constitutional, social, and political issues. And you can find these primarily or fairly easily on theragblog.com. And that's really an interesting site to check out. Theragblog.com. Lamar is also a significant member of the Hays County Free Thinkers Association here in, obviously in our county of Hays, as well as a member of the Final Exit Network. Just a little bit about the network, FEN, Final Exit Network, because we'll be talking about it a little later. But just for your information, FEN is a nonprofit, and the mission of the nonprofit is basically three-pronged: to educate qualified individuals in practical, peaceful ways to end their lives. Secondly, to offer a compassionate bedside presence if desired, and lastly, to defend their right to choose. It's an organization, again, you'll be interested in checking out for yourself and hearing more about. But I want to just briefly explain my personal interest in this topic, and it's my worst fear, and I think it's my sister's worst fear. And I think also that it's the worst fear of many others that are 65 years of age and older. And that's developing Alzheimer's disease or any other form of dementia. This concern, and for me it edges on being a fear, is real. And here's some stats I want to share with you just very quickly. First of all, the average death for American men, and this is, I think, 2022, 2023 data. It's up a little bit from COVID years, but the average death for American men is 74.8 years, and women, 80.3 years. And again, this is since COVID. A second fact, that today approximately 7 million Americans and almost 50 million worldwide have Alzheimer's disease. The risk of Alzheimer's, and this is, listen carefully to this, the risk of Alzheimer's doubles every 5 years after the age of 65. And after the age of 85, those that are 85 and older, one-third will have Alzheimer's or a form of dementia. So I realize that when we're talking about right to die and the quality of life issues, that there's more to be concerned about than dementia and Alzheimer's. Concerns like terminal illnesses that you might have, intractable pain, and irreversible physical conditions. So dementia is not the only concern when you're thinking about life and death issues. So I wanted to start basically by asking Lamar, because the first time I really started hearing about the right to death or the right to choose was probably in around 1975, and it was the Karen Quinlan case.
Yeah.
Is that when it it didn't start then, the movement for, you know, in terms of movement for the right to die in 75, or is that just when I was aware of it, or I guess a little background on this movement?
Okay. Well, that's probably when a lot of us became aware of it, was that particular case. I guess you could trace the origins maybe back to Socrates, or even further back, which is referenced in the name of the first major organization in the United States to promote the right to die, or death with dignity, some people like to call it. That started in 1980 when Derek Humphrey and some others created the Hemlock Society. So they named the society after the chosen substance that Socrates took to end his own life. Of course, that situation was a lot different. I mean, Socrates wasn't ending his life because of pain or anything. It was more of a political situation he was in that led him to want to end his own life. The Hemlock started in 1980. 10 years later, Derek Humphrey wrote a book called Final Exit, and in it he discussed many of the issues that we might talk about today. He was, of course, influenced by the Quinlan decision and some others, and the advent of advanced directives. The advanced directives started at the federal level in the late 80s. And if you've been in the hospital or to the hospital, or even to the doctor in many cases, you'll be asked whether you have advanced directives. And that all started, I think it was in 87, with the federal requirements that hospitals that received federal funding had to ask about this, and in order for people to know that they had the right to state in advance what sort of health care they wanted at any time in their lives, but particularly near the end of their lives. Then in 1998, I guess I could go back a little bit. In Humphrey's book, Final Exit, there were not a whole lot of choices about how to end your own life if you found yourself in an unacceptable, protracted health situation that you did not want to go through to the end. People would stockpile barbiturates, particularly. Some people would travel to Mexico to get effective barbiturates. It's very difficult nowadays to get those because they're tightly controlled by the federal government. But that was about the major way, because Humphrey argued that deaths, that when you take your own life, you should do so in a peaceful way. You should not resort to violent means to do so. Not everyone agrees with that view, but that was his premise, and the Final Exit Network certainly believes in a peaceful death, and there are new ways to achieve that now that Humphrey didn't have in 1990. In 1998, the Hemlock Society, with the leadership of Faye Gersh, who's still alive out in California, San Diego area, Faye initiated a program called the Caring Friends Program in Hemlock, And it was it came because of research that had been done on the use of helium to end your own life if you were in one of these situations where you were going to die a death you did not want to die. And the Caring Friends program had volunteers who taught people how to use helium to end their own lives. Now, helium is no longer a good choice because about 10 years or so ago, because of the shortage of the supply of helium in the world, the manufacturers started putting oxygen in with it. It's about a 20% mixture of oxygen. And so that makes it ineffective to end your own life. And that's when we switched to nitrogen about 10 years ago. It's another inert gas. Helium is an inert gas. Argon is an inert gas. And all of these are effective. And if you breathe them instead of oxygen, your brain will shut down very quickly. And you'll die because you're oxygen deprived. And your brain will stop functioning. And your heart will then stop functioning. So anyway, that's...
Yeah,
that's how this kind of developed that way.
Well, we're talking about the history of what has been used. Let me ask you a question: is it legal? I mean, you're talking about suicide. Is that criminal or that's nonsensical because they're dead?
Yeah, I usually try to avoid the word suicide as much as I can because of all the connotations that typically people who are suicidal or clinically depressed and are kind of driven to that as a last resort. Not everybody that takes their own life in a non-peaceful way is that way, but most of them are. But when it comes to taking your own life because of your health situation and your desire to have a good death, a peaceful death, the American Association of Suicidology that is made up of professionals who deal with suicide and the aftermath and what causes it and so forth, have stated very clearly on the record that people who use assisted dying, in at least in those states that have it, or 10 jurisdictions that have it, are not committing suicide. And you wouldn't apply that to them because they identified 15 differences between people who take their own life through suicide and people who take their own life because their health situation has become intolerable to them.
Yeah. We're using some terms now, suicide. There's assisted suicide, there's euthanasia, passive euthanasia, non-voluntary, voluntary euthanasia. Right. There are a lot of terms that are used in trying to describe what one can and cannot do. Euthanasia, illegal. Suicide, not criminal.
Yes.
And assisted suicide?
Well, let me comment on the suicide situation, first of all. Beginning maybe in the 60s, but ending sometime around the mid-90s, every state in the United States abolished their prohibitions against suicide. All you have to do is think about it for about 10 seconds and you realize that that what use is a law that says it's illegal to commit suicide because the person will already be dead.
Yes.
What has remained, however, is the prohibition in most states, not all states, but in most states against assisting in a suicide. But taking your own life is not illegal, and attending the death of someone who is taking their own life is also not illegal. What is illegal is, in most states, is assisting people to do so. But some states, like North Carolina, for instance, allow assistance in suicide, have for a long time. They don't have an assisted suicide law, but they do allow people to assist. And in fact, I've seen the death of someone who was assisted before the advent of helium, before it was available, and now nitrogen. So
there's a term that I've read, maybe other people have, and it's MAID, the acronym.
Yeah.
Medical assistance in dying. So we keep using the term assisted suicide or assisted die. But there's a fine line in what medical assisted assistance in dying is, and in terms of what that means and how you do that, how that process occurs, as opposed to what we think is assisted or non-voluntary, even euthanasia. So,
well, there have been 10 jurisdictions that allow assistance in dying. It all started in Oregon in about 1998 with the passage of a medical assistance in dying law there. And most of the laws that have been passed by other states since have followed the Oregon model. And now they're beginning to have a little divergence in the laws of a few states. But
well, Lamar, let's come back to that. We need to take a break, and we'll talk about several states that how they work this process. Stay with us. Come back.
And you are listening here on this Thursday, the 4th of April, 2024, to Human Interest here on KCSM, LPFM 104.1. As a reminder, the views expressed on this show are those of the host, the guests, and not necessarily those of KCSM or SMTXCRA, its governing board. We're going to be right back with you after this quick station ID break.
This is 1 minute, 2 minute break.
Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man.
April 15th is coming up fast. To make the process easier for some taxpayers, the Internal Revenue Service has launched a new free tool called Direct File, which allows eligible taxpayers to securely file their taxes online directly with the IRS. The Direct File pilot program, available at directfile.irs.gov, will save the time and money of approximately 19 million Americans across 12 pilot states, including Texas. To check your eligibility, go to directfile, that's one word, directfile.irs.gov.
Did you know that nearly 4 million Texans suffer from lung disease such as COPD, lung cancer, and asthma? On May 4th, you get two big chances to promote lung health in your community and have some fun at the American Lung Association's Texas Two-Step at Bobcat Stadium. Join us for the Lung Force Walk and the Fight for Air Climb and put your lungs to work. You choose your step. Visit either the lungforce.org/South Texas or fightforairclimb.org/South Texas to learn more and register today. We'll see you there.
The 6th annual All-Women's Art Show and celebration of International Women's Day is now underway at the Price Center in downtown San Marcos. With 104 entries by 98 area artists, beautiful imagery, fanciful treatments, and bold colors shine brightly in this vibrant new show featuring a women's view of the world. Works include fiber art, glass, painting, photography, assemblage, and more. The Female Gaze, How We View the World, hangs now through April 27th. Many of the works are for sale, and a portion of any sales benefits our ongoing art efforts. The Price Center at 222 West San Antonio Street is open Wednesday to Friday, noon to 5 p.m. and Saturday, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. For a complete list of activities and more information, visit price-center.org.
We were talking about Oregon, that state, and first state, I believe, that actually passed. But I think we want to start perhaps again and talk about the Supreme Court decision that led to states.
Well, actually, the main Supreme Court decision was issued in 1997, and a medical doctor in New York State, along with some other people there, including some people who were experiencing horrible medical issues that weren't going to improve, wanted to get medical assistance in dying. But the state of New York had a law that prohibited medical assistance in dying, and so a case was filed in the federal courts and made it up to the Supreme Court, and as to whether or not New York had a right to prohibit medical assistance in dying. And basically, the Supreme Court said yes, that states have the right to prohibit medical assistance in dying, and there is no constitutional right to die. But of course, there are no laws anymore to prohibit taking your own life. So the problem is to figure out how to do that within the confines of this law. Well, Oregon, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Maine, Montana, let me explain about Montana. It's a little different. There was a Supreme Court decision of the state of Montana that said that doctors had the right to prescribe lethal medication in that state. And so that we don't have a medical assistance in dying law there. We have a court decision about it. New Jersey, New Mexico, Vermont, Washington, those are the 10 states with Oregon that have medical assistance in dying laws. And the District of Columbia also has a medical assistance in dying law. And what every one of the medical assistance in dying laws say is that if you follow certain requirements, medical requirements mostly, then a doctor has the right to prescribe lethal medication for you, which you can take to end your own life. And so that's how it works. In all those jurisdictions, those 11 jurisdictions altogether.
One thing I noticed in those 10 states and then the District of Columbia, they're all blue states.
Yeah, I hadn't really looked at that question, but you're probably right as I think about it.
I thought that was
yeah,
not surprising. Maybe that's what I thought.
Right. Right, it looks that way, yeah. Although some of them, like Maine and New Jersey, just based on my general knowledge,
they can wiggle around.
Yeah,
they're
not as completely one way or the other.
Yeah.
But largely, what you say is correct.
Right.
But isn't it true you have to be a resident of the state? Like, I couldn't go from Texas to New Mexico without establishing residency to get that kind of assistance.
For most of the states, that's still true. But Vermont specifically included in their made law that you did not have to be a resident. It's not really that difficult to establish residency, but if someone is in a very horrible medical situation, it may be very difficult for them to relocate, and that's one of the problems. Now, Oregon, in all but one county in Oregon, I believe you don't have to establish residency any longer. But that was the result of a court case and one of the district attorneys in Oregon would not agree to it. So that county, this particular court ruling does not apply in Oregon. But from in most states, you have to establish residency. And that may be as simple, well, you'll have to move to that state. And so there's some expense involved also that you have to be mindful of. But it's a whole lot cheaper than flying to Europe, where there are medical assistance in dying systems there that some people are have been able to use. But that's a very expensive proposition. So going to Vermont's probably the least expensive way to do it.
You were talking earlier about directives, advanced directives. And I know that's something of great concern to you and of the Final Exit Network in terms of helping develop advanced, but for dementia. You know, we've got advanced directives. I believe that's what you referred to is for just general medical assistance.
Yes. Well, there are a lot of misunderstandings about advanced directives. Most of the states have developed forms for the residents of their state to use, to fill out, to tell a doctor and your family what sort of medical care you want at the, near the end of life or under varying circumstances. I mean, sometimes people have a stroke that's so severe they can't recover from it. And they, if they wrote in their advance directive some specific requirements for their care after having an illness of some sort that from which they will not recover and which will ultimately be fatal, and that they don't want to continue to live as a result of, then those have to be followed. The simplest thing to do is to say, in that situation where there's no chance of recovery or almost no chance of recovery, I direct the person that I have authorized to be my personal representative and make decisions about my health care if I'm not able to make them myself. I direct that person to cease all medical treatment for me. And, you know, if you have some medical condition, like a heart condition, for instance, and you were getting medication for it, and that was withdrawn, you would likely die from the heart disease quicker than you would otherwise. I mean, I've known people who had, you know, severe strokes. They could not do anything. They couldn't talk. They could not. They did not have the use of their arms or legs. They couldn't speak. Well, I already said they couldn't talk.
Yeah.
They couldn't speak anyway. And they did not want to continue to live in that situation. And so their medical agent knew this was their wish, and they were not able to communicate their desires. They may have still been mentally competent, but it was impossible to determine that because of the severity of the stroke. So their medical agent then makes the decision based on what the patient wanted, makes the decision and tells the doctors how to proceed. And one of the other things that in this regard that the Final Exit Network has developed is an addendum to an advance directive that will allow you to not be given food and drink so that you can die of dehydration, essentially, is what happens. You die of dehydration. And there are a lot of elaborate precautions. People have written books about how to use this particular process to end your own life. but it hasn't been tested in the courts yet, and we don't know whether it will, the courts will allow it to be honored or not. But you know, I wrote back in 2000, I guess it was. I wrote an advance directive to do that very thing, and I was concerned about it because about 5 years earlier, my father had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and so I had been thinking about it, and I had talked to a number of people who were knowledgeable about this, voluntarily giving up food and drink is certainly legal, and it's just a problem of what happens when you're not able to direct the process yourself because you're no longer competent. And certainly people in the later stages of Alzheimer's, or even in the middle stages, probably do not have sufficient mental capacity to contract and do other things, so they would not be able to make their own medical decisions.
Lamar, another station break. Please stay with us.
You're listening to KZSM, LPFM 104.1, San Marcos, Texas. You are listening to Human Interest here. And as a reminder, the views expressed on this show are those of the hosts and the guests, and not those of KZSM or SMTX here. We'll be right back with you.
Set your imagination free. Join local creator Karen Cross for a monthly open studio session at the Price Center from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. on the second Wednesday of each month. Karen provides a friendly and happy space along with a variety of tips and techniques for creating by yourself or with others. She focuses on recycled materials and art journals. Bring a project and your supplies, or just show up and plug in. Open studio sessions are free and open to all. Cash and art supplies donations, of course, are always welcome. The Price Center is located downtown at 222 West San Antonio Street. For more information, please call us at 512-392-2900.
Texas Preparatory School San Marcos invites all adults from the community for Walk With Us. Walk With Us is a twice-weekly opportunity for parents, teachers, and San Marcos community members to enjoy the benefits of walking together, engaging in conversations, building meaningful relationships, and strengthening the bonds that make San Marcos such a special place to live. Parents with children attending Texas Preparatory School can trust that their kids will be in capable hands while they enjoy the walk. To walk with us, please join us at 4 p.m. Tuesdays and Thursdays on our San Marcos campus, located at 400 Euland Road. Texas Preparatory School San Marcos is committed to its mission of enriching lives and empowering its community members. Walk With Us is an embodiment of this commitment.
Nearly 4 million Texans suffer from lung disease such as COPD, lung cancer, and asthma. But on May 4th, you get two big chances to promote lung health in your community and have some fun at the same time with the American Lung Association Texas Two-Step at Bobcat Stadium. Join us for the Lung Force Walk and the Fight for Air Climb on the stairs of the iconic stadium and put your lungs to work. Visit either lungforce.org/South Texas or fightforairclimb.org/South Texas to learn more and register today.
Thank you. Wanted to ask a little Lamar to maybe a little bit more information. He's two points he's made that I want us to think about a little further. And that was talking about we designate another person to be our decision maker if we were to be incompetent or some way not able to communicate. And I think I personally have been in this situation where I had to make an immediate decision on, well, for Mom, whether to have a surgery done quickly. And if I didn't make that decision quickly, she would most likely die. But if she did have it, they didn't know what the outcome would be. So you're left with that dilemma, and you think you know what they want, but then you're conflicted with what you want. And I that's probably a universal problem with another making decisions for you because of their ethics, their bioethical position. So,
well, the legal requirements for someone who is a medical agent for another person is not to substitute their judgment for the judgment of the patient.
Right.
The legal responsibility of a medical agent is to follow the wishes of the patient. And that's, of course, a problem because probably most people have not done an extensive look at all of the kinds of problems that might come up.
And right.
It's really
point.
Impossible to cover them all anyway. But there are some efforts that have been made. I've got a lengthy checklist that was developed by some doctors at Harvard Medical School a number of years ago that I attached to my my advanced directives to help direct my medical agent in the event I'm no longer competent at some point, to direct my medical agent as to what they should do in various situations. And this document that was done by these Harvard doctors has a list of all sorts of medical conditions. It goes on for 2-3 pages. I've forgotten how many. And next to each one of them, you have choices that you can identify that you wouldn't want to live in this situation. You would want to live if you could recover, and you want to live no matter what in that particular medical situation. So there are efforts that people are making and have made to try to find broad enough directions to your medical agent to cover whatever might happen, but there's no way to cover it all. I mean, you're going to come up with situations where the person has not made a decision. So you have to you have to have a very clear understanding. If you're a medical agent, you have to have a very clear understanding of the values of the person you are the medical agent for, and what their attitude about life is. Like the medical agent, one friend of mine who had a severe debilitating stroke that I mentioned earlier, she had made it very clear to her medical agent that exactly what she wanted in that situation. And so she was able to die by voluntarily stopping eating and drinking. And that is abbreviated as VSED, V-S-E-D, voluntarily stopping eating and drinking. And so, you know, a lot of people, I have this in my dementia directive, and the Finn dementia directive also has provisions for voluntarily stopping eating and drinking. And the problem with dementia, Alzheimer's, so forth, is if you don't want to live to the end of it, the problem is knowing when you have gotten to the point that you must go ahead and voluntarily end your own life,
yes.
Or you will get to the point where you're unable to do that. And that is a real tricky problem. But it's not only a tricky problem for people with Alzheimer's or dementia, it's a problem for lots of people. We have, I know someone, I've corresponded with her quite a lot, written about her, who is in her late 40s and has had progressive muscular diseases for quite some time, since she was maybe 25 or something like that. And since it's progressive, you know, it also comes and goes, and it changes from time to time. And so her dilemma is to know when she's gotten to a point beyond which she just cannot endure living any longer. But people with other neuro diseases like Huntington's disease and Parkinson's, and some people can live for a very long time with all of these diseases, but other with some people it gets very bad very quickly, and it's hard to know what you want. So it's important to let your medical agent have a clear understanding of what sort of life you want to live and when it's going to be time to say enough is enough. And that's a discussion that's very difficult for many people to have. And there are a lot of organizations that that are helping try to find ways to have those discussions. A number of years ago, the death cafes started getting to be prevalent around. I don't know that we have any here in San Marcos, but they certainly have them in Austin, where people who want to talk about these issues just get together in an informal atmosphere at a cafe or some place that will allow you to gather together and eat and drink and whatever while you're talking about this. And so there are a lot of efforts that organizations and just individuals are making to try to get people to think more about their lives and their deaths.
What is your experience personally through Finn talking with people dealing with the issue of part of their consideration is not only their life, but how their life and situations is impacting loved ones, family, you know, others?
Yeah. Well, for several years, I've had several different roles in Finn over the years. I've been a member since it was formed in 2004. What happened? Let me just explain this, just so this is understood.
Okay.
In 2004, the board of Hemlock changed, and the new board decided that they didn't like the name Hemlock any longer. They wanted to change it, so they went through a couple of changes in over just a few month period, combined with other organizations, and became Compassion and Choices. That is the actual successor to Hemlock is Compassion and Choices. But people who were with Hemlock, but Compassion and Choices ended the Caring Friends program at some point. And so people that were committed to the Caring Friends program in Hemlock formed the Final Exit Network that same year in 2004. And so it's continued. So I say that Finn is the philosophical successor to Hemlock.
Okay.
But Compassion and Choices is the legal successor to Hemlock. And I'm sorry, I've already gotten off track and forgot what you wanted me to talk about.
Well, I guess it's still, like you said, that the key is how does one know? And for me, I always think about having, I know you dealt with the death of your father with Alzheimer's.
Yes.
Becky and I, our mother, and Rob, I don't know if you've had someone in your life close that you've watched this process.
Not yet.
Well, that's, but, and a lot of research and writing on how this impacts the caretakers and all that. And I just, you don't know, well, I'm going to go out and contact Finn and start on this process because it's too important, you know, and it's something I have control over. Well, I have some control over.
That gets us back to the point I was moving toward that I forgot where I was. For a number of years, one of my volunteer roles with Final Exit Network was to be a coordinator. And this meant that I had a region of the country that I responded to requests by my people who wanted more information or they wanted to apply for the for the final, for the exit guide program, it's called. Yeah. And so I talked to hundreds of people over that period of time. I had a region up in the Northeast at one time, and then I moved to the Midwest for a period, and then finally to the Northwest. And it was surprising to me because I had seven states in the Northwest. Two of them were Oregon and Washington, which were the early adopters of medical assistance and dying laws. But because of the inadequacy of the way MAID laws work, we had more inquiries probably from Oregon and Washington than any other two states of people who wanted the help of the Final Exit Network, who wanted to participate in the Exit Guide program because of their medical condition. And so I talked to lots of people with lots of different sorts of problems, and some people were very thoughtful about it. For other people, though, it had kind of snuck up on them, and they realized that their life was just not a life that they wanted to continue to live because of the suffering they were going through. And while it's true that, you know, we have lots of medications to deal with pain, the doctors are still not able to solve all pain problems.
No.
And the way some of them are solved are unacceptable. For instance, I would not want to be comatose because of drugs that I was given to deal with pain for an extended period of time. And so that's no solution for some people who have pain that's just intractable.
Right. When I read that about the mission statement for FIN, the first thing it said, for qualified people.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, FIN has a number of standards. I mean, it's not unlike the states with medical assistance and dying laws. They have their own requirements. The most essential requirement is that you have to have a diagnosis that you're going to die within 6 months.
That's hospice.
That's medical assistance and dying laws.
Oh.
They all require that you have a terminal prognosis, which means that you're going to die within 6 months. Final Exit Network does not have any kind of time limit like that. Everything is based entirely on their medical condition and their life situation. There are a lot of things which are considered.
Well, does a group of you take this person's?
Okay, let me explain. Okay, when you first call the Final Exit Network, you'll get an answering service. In less than 24 hours, your phone number will be transmitted to a coordinator. The coordinator usually call people the same day I got their phone number, but it'll depend on people's workloads and so forth. But usually within 48 hours after you've applied or you've requested to talk to someone with Final Exit Network, you'll get a coordinator. The coordinator will explain all the requirements and ask you about your medical records and then we'll help you begin the process of gathering your medical records and submitting them to the coordinator. They're sent to the coordinator. The coordinator then takes the medical records, looks at them, and makes sure that they're going to be adequate for the purposes of what we call the Medical Evaluation Committee. And they will be sent then to the Medical Evaluation Committee with a statement by the person written by themselves about why they want to exit. And all that information will be provided. The Medical Evaluation Committee now includes, in addition to medical doctors, it always is. It was always medical doctors until the last year or so. And we've had a psychologist, a clinical psychologist has been added to it, and someone who's familiar with medical records has been added to it. And I'm not sure, you know, everybody, but anyway, most of the medical evaluation committee is made up of doctors, medical doctors, so who volunteer their time. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, what's the average length of that process? I guess it's how fast I get the documents to the committee?
There are a lot of things. I mean, it's possible within 3 or 4 weeks to get a decision.
Oh, wow. Faster than I thought.
But, that's probably the exception. I mean, if the person has all the medical records that are needed and can get them to you right away, then it can go very fast after that. After all the medical records are obtained, the coordinator also arranges for what I call a structured interview. And so someone else who's been trained will then do a structured interview with the person on the phone. And that may take 30, 45 minutes, an hour. It just depends on the situation. Mm-hmm. They then write up a report of what they have learned in the interview, and that also is submitted to the medical evaluation committee. And we look at a lot of factors, you know, whether the person's family is on board with their plans or not, because that's very important to determine, and whether the person has advanced directives and things like that. But then, I would say it's more likely to take 6 to 8 weeks, but it will depend. And sometimes people, once they are accepted, and once they are taught how they can end their own life in a peaceful manner, they're not ready yet. And this happens also in medical assistance in dying jurisdictions, where a person will get the lethal medication from their doctor after they've been approved, and they won't take it right away.
A couple of quick questions, because I'm seeing our time is running quickly out, and maybe it's just a brief answer. I believe you said the chemical substance now, because of the oxygen being placed in helium, it's nitrogen N2.
Yes.
And it's, and so that's just a gas that one breathes in. And so why is that not used in prisons when there's the death penalty?
Well,
if it's so peaceful and
In fact, Alabama just did execute someone, but it's not a good substance for an involuntary situation.
Yes. Okay. Because of the breathing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The if a person doesn't want to die, I mean, that's involuntary. You know, that's that is sort of like involuntary euthanasia.
Yeah.
And so if a person does not want to die, they can do everything within their power to not breathe in the nitrogen. But people who are ready to die because of their medical condition and because of their suffering, it nitrogen works exceedingly well.
Okay. I can see that. Yeah. Well, I want to end. Do you anything you want to kind of close with or say that we've not touched on?
I want to say most people die in circumstances where seeking an early death is not wanted or is not needed. So while we've been talking about this, it's not a huge number of
it's
people.
It's not common, is it?
Right. I mean, even in those states, the 10 states that we can't include Montana because no one gathers data, but the incidence of people who die in those 10 states or jurisdictions using medical assistance in dying is very small. It's like 0.002 1% of all deaths. So most people are going to die natural deaths without any problem at all. You know, they will not be unhappy yeah. with their circumstance of their death. Well, so this is for people, you know, who are concerned about the issues.
I don't know the stat, and I'm not asking, but it just occurred to me how many suicides there are, mm-hmm. you know, the older, you know, that it's got to be done today, and, you know, that there's, I don't know the stat, but I bet it's higher than assisted.
Well, in 2019, there were 47,511 suicides recorded in the United States, and many, many fewer people.
Yeah.
Take their own life through MAID or through the Fine Lakes Network.
Well, one of the things I want to mention, because I started out talking about personally concern with dementia and Alzheimer's, and I want to also leave on kind of a higher note than perhaps some people might think we... I like what we've shared. I think it's important information to know. But the thing I want to say about Alzheimer and dementia is... aging and genetics are not, they're factors. They're not causes of dementia. They're factors. Another big kind of set of factors, and I talk about this a lot, and it's addressing brain health. And so our diet that we talk about, we think about our body and our weight, but what we eat, the exercises that we do, the mental exercises like lifelong learning, sleep, adequate sleep, no tobacco, limited alcohol, like one drink for a woman and two maybe for a man per day. There are specific things that we can do to minimize or somehow offset dementia. It doesn't mean it will prevent it, but they are factors, because all of those factors impact the blood flow to your brain and the nutrients to your brain and what's feeding heart brain, that heart brain connection. And it's, I just want people to know that there are things we can do to live a healthier life, and what we've been talking about is a more quality death. But we're alive now, or you wouldn't be listening. So do the things you can do, and I hope that you'll join us next month, and thank you for listening. Lamar, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Happy to be here.